Hello, welcome to this week's Opening Bell podcast. I'm Boxing News editor Tris Dixon, back in the saddle, safe to say, after a while. And I'm joined by Matt Christie, my old accomplice. How's it going, Matt?
Yeah, going good, going well.
What's been the high point of your week so far?
The high point of the week so far? I don't know, probably eventually getting through to Kell Brook on Monday evening, so we could get the interview in this week's issue.
Did he sound positive?
Yeah, certainly he certainly sounded positive in regards to getting back into action as soon as possible, wanting Amir Khan and then Floyd Mayweather and what have you. A lot of positive noises, and also he's now walking without crutches. Which has got to be a positive after what he went through in Tenerife.
What's been the low point of the week for you, boxing-wise?
I don't know, I found the whole Tyson Fury with his mouth taped up at the press conference a little frustrating. I completely understand where he's coming from, but it smacked of another publicity stunt, really, rather than him saying, OK, hold my hands up, I shouldn't have said that. And the other low point, which I'm kind of just about to start writing about, is the whole Floyd Mayweather access all areas being staged admission, which...
What are your thoughts on that? You've seen it, you were out there in Vegas and stuff. What are your thoughts? I mean, do you think they should just take Mayweather's word for it? I mean, what else can they do?
I don't know. I know television quite well. You can edit these things to come out with whatever impression you're trying to really. I don't know what else they can do unless they delve deeper, because there will be the original footage there, which they've had to have edited in the first place, which will give them a definitive answer on whether or not it was all staged and whether it was, as Floyd is now saying. Either way, it's not good. Either way, whichever if he was doing this kind of, as he called it, fight to the death, kind of activities in the gym, it's bad for boxing. And if this was openly staged by Floyd, then it kind of casts a shadow over what has been a very, very enjoyable series over the years.
Okay, interesting stuff. You're obviously back, refreshed from Las Vegas and back in the swing of things. What's your outstanding memory from the trip now when you look back on it?
Probably meeting Juan Manuel Marquez, I would say, would be the highlight. He was very affable, English was delicate, if not completely broken. So it was good to catch up with him. But the whole fight week, I always enjoy when you're out there. It's you do kind of take it as a once in a lifetime experience, even though we have been lucky to experience it more than once. But you do kind of take it every time you're out there that you kind of try and treat it as if it might be your last visit. It's hard to explain to people that haven't been lucky enough to experience that, and I do stress that I have been lucky to experience it. But that whole build-up can often be a more enjoyable experience than the actual fighting.
Okay, do you know what's getting me this week? Are you bothering me?
Boxing-wise?
Yeah, boxing-wise.
No, tell me.
Do you know, I've just been writing the preview for Jermaine Taylor against Sam Solomon.
Ooh.
There's like a bad smell out in the office from where I've written that preview. It's just, it really sticks in my throat that people are getting title shots for services rendered. I know we had it with Shane Mosley a couple of years ago. But, so many young, hungry fighters out there, deserving fighters, who should have an opportunity at Sam Solomon. That for Jermaine Taylor to somehow be manoeuvred into this, it's miraculous.
It really is. It really is. He's done absolutely nothing, and I think it's worrying as well. In that there's obviously issues with his health after that fight with Abraham and the previous, tough fights he'd been involved with. But it's nothing new, is it? This, well, it's nothing new.
Talking of Abraham, he's fighting this week. Got a big fight against Paul Smith. initially I thought Paul Smith doesn't have a great chance in the fight. The closer it gets, I suppose this is always the case with underdogs, you think, oh, well, maybe, just maybe. But talking of Taylor not deserving a shot at Sam Solomon, what's Paul Smith done to merit a shot at Arthur Abraham?
No, he hasn't. He doesn't deserve it. I'm not going to begrudge Paul a shot at all. But no, he hasn't done it. His two biggest fights, you could argue, were losses to James DeGale and George Groves, and both were of the emphatic nature. A lot of promise around Smith when he first turned professional.
There was a buzz around him after the contender as well.
Yeah, there was, and he's a talented guy. And I mean, I remember that first round against George Groves where he had the better of that first round. Groves looked in trouble right at the end. I'm not writing Smith off at all in this. It would be an upset. It would create a few shockwaves across the world, I reckon, if Smith walked away with the belt. I think the only thing going in his favour is that Abraham, to me, seems years beyond his best.
And was never brilliant at super middleweight anyway.
No.
He never recovered his middleweight form when he moved up and went into the 60s.
No.
But, okay, so percentage-wise, how would you have it? It's not a 50-50 fight, is it?
60-40, I'd put it.
Do you reckon?
Yeah, I'd put 60-40.
80-20 for me, I think. But it depends. It depends on how you call it, doesn't it? I mean, Matthew Macklin's on the undercard. I wouldn't mind seeing him against Abraham.
Yeah, that'd be...
That obviously, they'd have to do it at a catchweight or something.
Yeah, no, that'd be a tear-up, wouldn't it?
Obviously, overseas, Artur Babertiev is easy for me to say. He's fighting Tavoris Cloud. I mean, what a step up after five fights, isn't it?
It is a step up. I think you can make a pretty strong argument that Cloud is nowhere near the fighter he was. And it reminds me a little bit of when Bobut Shubinov came along at light heavyweight and he took a couple of steps up within his first, you know, six or seven fights. And they were deemed pretty high steps, and he made them very easily. And I've just got a feeling that that'll be the case this weekend.
Okay, I mean, Cloud's one of those guys who you could argue he hasn't been the same fighter since he lost to Hopkins.
No, he hasn't been the same fighter since he lost to Hopkins. He hasn't really been the same fighter since he won the title almost. He kind of came along.
He looked brilliant against Clinton Woods, didn't he?
Yeah, and before that, yeah, and when he beat Gonzalez, was it? He stopped him, became the first man to stop Gonzalez. And he looked really, really strong, looked a real destroyer. But I think it was Gabriel Campillo who kind of exposed him a little bit. And Cloud was judged to have got quite a lucky verdict there. But yeah, I thought Cloud was going to be something a bit like Sergei Kovalev has turned out to be. But that, I think the clock really is ticking and could be running out for Tavoris Cloud.
Okay, we've talked about a few of the downers. Do you know what's exciting me this week?
What is exciting you this
good
week?
I think what you were thinking when you said
I would say, what is exciting you this week, and this is with the benefit of conversations we've had this week, I would say perhaps Chris Eubank and his son are exciting you this week.
Yeah, I'd say so. I think, you know, they give us some colour, don't they? You know, when you come to the office, you speak to a lot of professionals, you either deal with them or you read about them, I hear you guys on the phone to them. And all lovely guys, as you know, to a man, pretty much in the fight game. But there's obviously something that clearly separates Chris Eubank Senior and Junior from the rest of the pack, and it's not just them really that excites me, because obviously if they've been putting around on Channel 5 like they have, fighting, you know, with all due respect, nobodies or people who aren't going to come anywhere near denting his charge to any kind of domestic titles. What's really exciting me is this fight that's been announced today with Billy Joe Saunders, which I think is a fantastic match. I really do. I mean, cracking blend of personalities, fighting styles. It's got everything. You know, two very ambitious guys. It's got the unanswered questions of, you know, how will Billy Joe cope in a real grudge fight? And the question that everyone wants to know about Eubank is he the real deal? You know, because it's such a massive step going from beneath domestic level to fighting the European champion. It's such a huge step for Eubank Jr. to take. and it makes you, you know, is there a method behind the madness or not? And you know, it's a brilliant fight. Great questions to answer. You often find, I think, with these fights, or certainly I do now, the more unanswered questions you have going into the fight, the more enjoyable the whole ride is. I seem to remember there being so many before the second Froch Groves fight, so many unanswered questions. Some obviously that carried over from the first fight. But the unanswered questions going into this is brilliant, and it's going into that unknown that really pulls, I think, a fight fan in. Obviously, you know, we've all seen, I don't know, I was going to say hundreds, it could even be thousands of 60-54 fights, or 40-36, or 100 to 90 point fights. You know, we've seen them all before, and we've seen, you know, contenders and pretenders against journeymen, and, you know, we've seen the script written, we've seen it torn up and everything else, but they're these fights where there's no real script as such. You know, you just put two young hungry guys in and see what comes out of it.
Well, well, yeah, yeah. There's not much else to say. It is, to me, it's the best domestic fight this year in terms of intrigue. I hope
it. Apart from Froch Groves, too.
Well, yeah, maybe, but I don't know. I don't know. There's something about this fight which really, really does tick all the boxes. It obviously will not be of the scale of Froch Groves, but Eubank, Billy Joe Saunders is a brilliant, as you say, brilliant matchup for all the reasons you just mentioned. And for such a long time now, we've been hearing that Chris Eubank Jr. is special. We've heard it from his dad, we've heard it from some insiders, we've heard it from guys that have sparred him. But although, you know, we have seen him on, you know, Sky, Box Nation, Channel 5, we haven't had true evidence in the professional ring that he is the real deal, although he's beaten all that's come in front of him. But as you say, there's barely been a fighter he's beaten with a winning record. So, you know, it's all, and you do think, though, that Eubank Senior, who is kind of, what did he say recently or last year? I'd pick my son to beat any super middleweight on the planet, bar Andre, or any middleweight super middleweight bar Andre Ward.
Yeah.
So you would think that they're not going into this half-heartedly, and that it would not have happened unless Eubank Senior was absolutely 100% convinced that his son had the beating of Billy Joe Saunders.
Yeah, I agree. It's absolutely fascinating stuff. Also on the bill, Tyson Fury, Derek Chisora. I think we know that going into the last fight, the majority of people were favouring Fury. I still think that most people calling that fight ahead of time will pick Fury. Frankie Gavin against Bradley Skeet's also been announced for that bill. Discuss, Matt.
It's an awkward fight back for Frankie Gavin. Again, you can compare it to the Eubank Jr. Billy Joe Saunders fight in that, as an unbeaten guy, a lot is expected of Bradley Skeet. He's done what he's had to so far. Gavin, huge, huge step up. It really, for me, depends. I mean, also Skeet's style could play havoc with Frankie Gavin.
But with Gavin's style.
Yeah, exactly. And it depends, you know, it really is. I mean, I think what we need to see now from Frankie Gavin after that tight, but I think deserved loss to
Bundu.
We need to see that ambition is still there, and perhaps the ambition has now increased. And we, you know, will we see a better fighter after that Bundu performance?
Style-wise, it doesn't really tick the boxes, though, does it, Skeet Gavin? I think I can see it being a close fight on points one way or another, but fight of the year contender, Matt?
I'd be surprised.
Interesting stuff. Yeah, I mean, but, you know, what do you want? You want 50-50 fights. It's not quite a 50-50 fight, but like you say, it's a good test for Gavin coming back from his first defeat. He's got to realign and come again, and Skeet's a good opponent, a good young unbeaten opponent to do that against. But obviously it won't get a great deal of limelight because of the two other fights on the bill, which are monstrous domestic showdowns, really, aren't they?
They are. But let me ask you a question. Say if Skeet comes out of it with a victory, say it's a messy kind of points win or whatever, Gavin has lost two in a row, career in tatters. Is that one of the biggest British disappointments of recent years, considering what we expected of Frankie Gavin, and some still do expect?
For some, possibly. For me, no, because I think the writing's been on the wall now for a long time for Gavin as a professional. You still hope that he will make that step up and look quality, but you know, there's always been stuff in the background, seemingly, with Frankie. You know, I agreed with Frank Warren ages ago when he was saying fairly prolifically that Gavin would have been better at light welterweight than welterweight. And although Gavin showed all that talent and class in the amateurs, obviously becoming our first ever world amateur champion, how many times has he really translated that kind of form in the pros? You know, he really toiled in that Curtis Woodhouse fight, and he's had a lot of issues going on outside the ring. It's been a very, very hard ride for Frankie Gavin. And I think as an interested observer along that ride, you never really thought that he had a clean slate to work from. Mm. There's always been something hanging over him, and it's always been difficult for Frankie. And of course, you know, you can say with his style, he's not a heavy puncher. He's not a concussive hitter, and at a certain level, you need to have that.
Yeah.
Or you need to not be hit. And you know, he's gone through his career, and he's taken some quite decent shots. And I'd say it's not a massive surprise he is where he is. I mean, look, where he is now is still a really good level. He's just lost a European title fight. Mm. You know, there's no shame in that.
No, not at all.
There's no disgrace in that. And I'm sure there've been a couple of certainly European champions that he could have beaten. But also, when you look at the world scene at welterweight, you're looking at guys like Brook, Sean Porter, Amir Khan, Lucas Matisse, these guys. You know, I'm not sure that you could. I'm not sure. You know, obviously the proof of the pudding would be in the eating. But from what I've seen, I couldn't put Frankie Gavin up there amongst them.
No, I think he is talent-wise. I think you could, but I think you kind of hit the nail on the head in what you said and what Frank Warren said, in that he's not a huge puncher, and by fighting what seems to be slightly above what would be his best weight, that diminishes his power even further. And you could see it really in the Bundu fight, that he was struggling to get Bundu's respect late on. And that, I think, could probably be his undoing ultimately if he does make that step up.
Yeah, interesting. Talking of a step up, George Groves made a step back into the ring last weekend. He beat Frenchman Christopher Rabras. In a fight that pretty much went the way most people thought. It would be good, competitive, for the most part. I think people expected 12 rounds of action. I don't think anyone thought Groves would blow him out of there. I mean, was that the sort of fight that he needed?
It was good that he got the 12 rounds. It was good that he stood up to some, you know, it was, as I speak to someone the other day, it was an entertaining one-sided fight. Yeah, it'll be what he needs, but I've noticed he's got quite a lot of criticism on the back of it. He almost didn't look as sharp against Rabras as he did against Carl Froch. I suppose you could expect that given, you know, the nature of those events. Groves, I certainly think, is a world-class fighter who would test, at the very least, any of the champions in the super middleweight division.
Even Andre Ward?
You know, he'd be a test. He wouldn't. I don't think he'd fare any worse than say Chad Dawson and Carl Froch. But whether he will be able to go to the next level, and that next level now must be winning a world title rather than just contesting for one, I do still have my doubts, I must admit.
Hmm. Interesting. Bernard Hopkins, by the way, we're not far away from his fight with Sergey Kovalev. If you put Hopkins, Kovalev and Adonis Stevenson all in one room, who comes out?
Depends what they're doing in there.
Okay, who's the best of the three light heavyweights?
I think Stevenson, who did he fight last?
It was after, Fonfara.
Fonfara, his stock dropped with that performance, I think. I would probably put Stevenson third, and at the moment I'd probably put Kovalev at the top, but It's a really hard fight to call the Kovalev-Hopkins fight, because Hopkins has never lost this kind of fight before. Really, really hard to call. But you can also, more so I think than in any fight he's had, you can also foresee a situation where he could just get blown away.
Do you know what, it's nearly 13, what is it this week? 13 years ago this week, I was in a car with former light heavyweight champion Matthew Saad Mohammed on my way up to Madison Square Garden to watch Hopkins fight Felix Trinidad in a fight he was expected to lose at middleweight. Obviously, that was arguably his crowning achievement, beating Trinidad back then in the final of the Don King tournament. And it's astonishing that 13 years on, Hopkins is now at light heavyweight and fighting the likes of Kovalev. And even then, I mean, people were saying that Trinidad was going to beat Hopkins then because he was too old.
Yeah, I know. It is. He's a wondrous fighter. What he's achieved, without question, in my mind, he is the out of you got. There's a few guys that are still fighting that, you know, you can question whether they will achieve what we would call greatness, whether they will be up there with the very best of all time. And out of the likes of Manny Pacquiao, out of the likes of Floyd Mayweather, I believe that Bernard Hopkins, with what he has achieved in his career, is above those guys.
If you put one guy in the Hall of Fame, Roy Jones, James Toney, or Bernard Hopkins, who would you
induct? Hopkins.
Would you?
Hopkins, yeah, definitely. I just think what is it? I think going back to what you said, in that people were writing him off before he fought Felix Trinidad, but it's not just that performance. It's the fact that then he came back and then he lost those fights to Jermaine Taylor. There was evidence there, perhaps, that he was in decline. Then he lost to Joe Calzaghe. That seemed to confirm it. Back he came. He beat Kelly Pavlik, and then he lost fairly conclusively to Chad Dawson. That really looked like the end. But again, he came back. He's beaten Jean-Pascal.
Cloud.
Tavoris Cloud, Shumanov. What he's done and what he keeps on doing is, you know, he's one of the best athletes in the whole of sport, let alone in boxing.
Do you know what, we'll close on that. 49-year-old Bernard Hopkins, tweet me, please, at Boxing News Ed, with your best one-line description of Bernard Hopkins. Not one word, one line. Describe Hopkins and his achievements. And if you bring a smile to my face or Matt Christie's, then we will get in touch with you and we'll send you out a prize. So guys, look, thanks a lot for joining us. Matt, it's been a pleasure.
Cheers, thank you.
And we'll be back with you next week.